Now, can I invite to join us on the platform Monsieur Olivier Tell, who will be our second speaker. Now, Monsieur Tell is a member of, well, in fact, he's the head of criminal procedural law in the Justice Directorate. I think his ultimate boss we've already seen on screen. Now, Monsieur Tell's earlier career, as it seems to me, demonstrates the strength of the magistrature française, the a French judiciary, and also, in mirror image of that, of the French civil service. Because Monsieur Tell graduated in law, I think, in 1984 and thereabouts. 84,
yes.
84. And took up his first judicial appointment in 1988. Now, I'm sure this had something to do with his exceptional abilities, but that, of course, reflects the career path in France, where judges are appointed at a relatively young age, and then in the course of their career, they will tend to go from court to court, but they may also, as Monsieur Tell did, spend a time in the Ministry of Justice. And as it appears to me, an effect of this is, and then return to the bench, as again Monsieur Tell did, and then in Monsieur Tell's case, went to work for the Commission in 2003. And as it appears to me, that must strengthen both the judiciary and the civil service because of this this crossover. As Professor Baker has already flagged up, as we know from the events of this year and indeed from this week, the future in Europe is, well, a little bit up in the air. And will there be a Greece to take the presidency of the Council in 2014? We don't know. But Monsieur Tell has very kindly, I don't think he has a crystal ball to tell the future, but he can give us some indications of where it would appear that the more likely developments are he will point to the more current, more likely future and current developments in criminal justice in Europe. Monsieur Tell.
Thank you very much, Lord Brody. I don't have a PowerPoint. I just rely on my notes. First of all, I would like to warmly thank the Scottish Association for the Study of Offending for its invitation and hospitality. It's an honor and a real pleasure for me to be in Dunblane for your 42nd annual conference to address the current and future developments of criminal justice in Europe. It's really a unique organization, I think, in Europe, and a unique opportunity for me to speak between you, in front of you, sorry. Our objectives in the EU is to create a real single era of justice. This is the ultimate goal, so to speak, ultimate political goal, which is enshrined in the treaty and which is also repeatedly said in the four programs, the three programs that has just been presented to you by Madame. Citizens, in what we are doing, we are not doing it for law practitioners, for judges. We are judges, law practitioners, officials, they are actors of the system. What we are doing it for the citizens, for all the citizens. We're trying to build a Europe for citizens. That's why it's important to understand that we want to create an era where citizens, all citizens, should be confident that their rights will be protected, no matter where they are in the 27 member states. There should be no difference in protection when citizens work, travel, or live outside their own countries. You mentioned, Madame, the freedom of movement, which encourages EU citizens to travel to other member states and so on. This is the main driver of our action. Up to recently, progress in criminal justice in Europe has been rather limited, or the focus has much more been on law enforcement, security issues. You mentioned the European arrest warrant, for example, which is the most prominent measure adopted just after the 9/11 events. But there have been also several other framework decisions or instruments related to the strengthening of fight against organized crime, trafficking in human beings, and so on and so on. The Lisbon Treaty allows us now, however, to finally rebalance our actions and focus more on justice and fundamental rights. The European Commission and my commissioner, Viviane Reding, is really determined to create a strong Europe of justice for our citizens. Commission also wants to ensure that the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which is now our key instruments, our key reference, the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU, is fully respected and is an integral part of our policies. When we are preparing a draft directive, for example, we have to respect, within the Commission, we have to respect the Charter of Fundamental Rights. And this is new. This is not just something which is in the sky. Before that, and I worked before that, we were not working the same way. Now, especially in the field of criminal law, we have to be sure that all provisions we are drafted, we are preparing, are charter-proof. We call it in our jargon, charter-proof. And we are doing that, and I can tell you this is very difficult, under the control of our colleagues from the Fundamental Rights Directorate. So for the past couple of years, we are moving forward, and we hope so, with policies that balance our cross-border responses to crime with rules that build trust between national justice systems. We are not just building a criminal justice era, but an era of justice for all. This is a new perspective, and this is a new step of European integration. To develop this new common era, where national law enforcers and judiciaries can trust and rely on each other, we need, of course, to rely on the Lisbon Treaty, but also we need a strong political impetus and a strong political will. For this to work, our starting point is a respect for the cornerstone principle of the treaty, which is the principle of mutual recognition between EU member states of each other's judicial decision. Mutual trust means also that judiciaries can trust each other's standards of fairness and justice. And this is not self-evident, I would say, even today. It also means, as I said, that citizens can have confidence in the fairness of the proceedings and can rely on a sound protection of their rights where they are in another country. But not only in another country, but also in their home country, because our legal basis basically allows us to harmonize criminal procedure law. This is exactly basically what we are doing. We have to make sure that people who get involved in criminal proceedings, whether they are suspect or accused of having committed crime, or whether they are victims of crime, are protected in all member states, even if the person involved have crossed borders from another member state. So basically, our action is developing in three directions. First, our main priority is to enhance the procedural rights of suspected and accused person. The second direction is to promote the rights of victim. And thirdly, we want to enhance mutual recognition of decisions in the field of criminal matters and judicial cooperation. I will probably insist more on the main priority for the moment, my main priority, which is to develop procedural rights in general. Some of you may wonder why the EU is involved in procedural rights in criminal proceedings. You had part of the response with the first intervention, but you may think indeed that the European Convention of Human Rights addresses this issue. I have as a former judge, as a lawyer, a great respect with the regard to the European Convention of Human Rights. But within the scope of the EU, what we are working to do is to streamline the rights of Article 6 of the CHR, and if possible, to codify, codify these rights for the benefits of the citizens. Because by definition, within the scope of the convention, we are dealing with case by case. So each decision is a specific case. And that's not enough to protect all citizens within the context of all the EU. Additionally, judicial cooperation between authorities in member states is now usually made by way of mutual recognition, which means that a judicial decision, such as, for example, an arrest warrant, taken by a judge in one member state, must be executed in another member state. For that to be effective, to work properly, there has to be mutual trust. We will only have mutual trust in Europe if each member state has earned that trust by showing its neighbors that it has a criminal justice system that guarantees fair trials. That may be obvious in UK, but this is not something which is always obvious. I used to learn, I don't know if it's true, but I used to listen to that English lawyers consider, or British, that they have the best criminal justice system in Europe, if not in the world. But so how could you understand that a decision given by a British judge should pass a kind of trust test to be enforced in another member state? But this is the situation today. Of course, for all decisions, there has been several problems within the UK with regard to the enforcement of European arrest warrants issued by other member states. I don't want to comment the news, but this is the most prominent part of it. But this situation of lack of trust with regard to decisions coming from other member states, it's not only in the UK that it happens, it happens also in the other member states. So that's what we have to address. Fair trial rights, which means ensuring that an accused person has an interpreter, for example, if he doesn't understand the language, or has access to a lawyer, even if he can't afford to pay for it. Of course, this can cost money, and we are aware of that. We do not pretend the Commission that it doesn't has financial, it doesn't have financial implications. Of course, it does, but this also reform that we are undertaking can also save money for the taxpayers, and in any case, this is not because this has a cost that we're not going to enhance the rights. This is much more important for us. But I have to say, especially when negotiating the directive in the Council, that the cost issue is more and more important in the current context that you know, as you can imagine. It's on the other side of the coin, it's also important, and we see that more and more, because we are also working in the framework of the efficiency of justice and the monitoring of the efficiency of justice of some member states. It's also very important in these difficult economic times that a country must have a very good justice system so to attract inward investment, to encourage companies and individuals to move there in a sure knowledge that the rule of law is respected. And that's very important, and we also are working on that in Directorate General of Justice. EU citizens who live in another EU country must never feel also that their rights are weakened because they left home. We want to avoid what has happened to many EU citizens, and there are many examples in UK with regard to the European arrest warrant. I'm thinking about the case of Edmond Harapi. I'm thinking about the case of these two British businessmen who went voluntarily to another state to stand trial under the European arrest warrant, but found themselves in a long pretrial detention and then released without charge and without explanation. So the question now is whether the public concern arose by these cases in UK, but also in other member states, will make it harder for British authorities to execute similar requests in the future. We have to rebuild citizens' trust in the European justice. The role of lawmakers, among you there are lawmakers, could not be clearer. Improve citizens' faith that so that their rights are protected across Europe and make sure judicial authorities also can be confident of that. EU governments has adopted in 2009, during the Swedish presidency, a roadmap on procedural rights. We call it the Stockholm roadmap, which is a Stockholm program and a Stockholm roadmap. And we have a Hungarian roadmap, we call the Budapest roadmap on victims' rights, which has been adopted during the previous Hungarian presidency. So each presidency gives its names to roadmap. Gave the Commission the political mandate to press ahead in this very important era of procedural rights. Now that the Lisbon Treaty gives us or provides us with more flexible voting rules, we have the means to achieve our aims, or we hope so, even if I would say one or two member states does not agree. Provided that, of course, that in the Council we move to what I could call a culture of unanimity, meaning veto rights, to a culture of consensus, which might take time to enter into the minds of the member states. But of course, we can rely on the European Parliament, which is now co-legislator with the Council of Ministers, and it is really the starting point. And we have experienced a very, I would say, tough negotiation co-decision for the second measure of the roadmap. And I think it will take time in this matter of criminal matters for the actors, Council, Parliament, will take time for them to get use of the new rules of the Lisbon Treaty and to be able to adopt more smoothly, I would say, measures like it was the case in the civil law side during the last decade. I will move now to what we are doing. It is, having in mind this, that Commission has taken action to achieve the full set of procedural rights. We have, following a proposal of the Commission, the Council and the Parliament has adopted last year a directive on the right to interpretation and translation in criminal proceedings. Member States have before October 2013 to implement it. This is the first milestone of all this procedural rights roadmap. A draft directive on the right to information about your rights and about the charges is under negotiation, and Council and Parliament have just reached last week an agreement between themselves. So this second step will be adopted soon. This is a very important text. I have it in front of me. For example, all citizens which are suspected, which are arrested, will be given a letter of rights, which will contain all their rights within the criminal proceedings. For example, the letter, they will have to be informed about their right to access to a lawyer, and any entitlement to legal advice free of charge, and the conditions for obtaining it, the right to be informed about the accusation, the right, of course, to interpretation and translation, their right to remain silent. People who are under arrest, on arrest, will have the right to be informed, and this will be in the letter of rights in all EU languages, of the fact they have the right to access to the materials of the case, which is a revolution in some member states. I don't know for UK, but I can tell you that in right to the documents, the materials of the case, a right to have consular authorities informed, a right to access to urgent medical assistance, or many days, hours, he may be deprived of liberty before being brought before a judicial authority, etc. The right to information about the accusation also is enshrined. And, as I said previously, very importantly, the right to access to the material of the case. For example, a person who is arrested and detained at any stage of the criminal proceeding will have the right to have access, or his or her lawyer, to documents related to the specific case in possession of the police, for example, which are essential for her or him to effectively challenge the lawfulness of the arrest of detention. This also covers all material evidence in the possession of the police or prosecutors for or against the suspected or accused persons, etc. I don't know for you. I don't think it's, but I can tell you for my country, for example, it's a revolution. Because today, despite of the French law, the lawyers who assist somebody who's in custody but does not have access to the file. Now, tomorrow, this directive, implemented by France, they will have mandatory access to the files and to the evidence. The first step is the proposed directive, proposed directive on the right of access to a lawyer, which has been adopted in June, and the right to notify a third party and consular authorities of the detention. This proposal, we call it Measure C in our jargon, covers a recent line of the case of the European Court of Human Rights, inaugurated by the seminal Saldus case, Saldus versus Turkey, of 2008, followed by something 80 decisions from the European Convention of Human Rights, which have confirmed that Article 6 requires that a suspect can benefit from the assistance of a lawyer already at the initial stages of police interrogation. Our proposal addresses what activities the lawyer can carry out on behalf of his client. The client has the right to meet the lawyer. The lawyer has the right to attend the questioning, for example. The lawyer has the right to attend evidence gathering when the person itself has the right to be present, etc. The proposal also addresses the issue of confidentiality, waiver, because you can waive your right, of course, access to a lawyer, derogations, which are very limited, only life and limb, so-called life and limb derogation, and legal representation in European Ireland. This is an important novelty because we heard, stakeholders who said to the Commission that the system of European arrest warrant is not enough protective of rights, and that's why we provided for the assistance by a lawyer, not only in the executing state, but also in the issuing state. The proposal also covers the right to communication with relatives. This is to ensure that a person who has been arrested or deprived of his liberty is able to have his family, his employer, informed of the detention. Next year, we will adopt a measure on procedural rights of vulnerable persons, meaning children and other vulnerable persons. You know there are specificities in the criminal justice, in the criminal procedural law with regard to children. For example, the fact that, in principle, we will provide for mandatory defense for children. And the last legal aid has been, minimum standards on legal aid has been postponed until 2013. We are making, for the time being, an impact assessment. We are studying all the systems of the member states with regard to legal aid. It's a very complex matter, which has a lot of financial implications, of course. And the last part, it's very interesting probably for your organization, is detention. We have adopted, the Commission has adopted the 14th of June 2011, a green paper on strengthening mutual trust in the European era, a green paper on the application of EU criminal justice legislation in the field of detention. We analyze the impact on the application of four EU instruments, European arrest warrant, the framework decision transfer of prisoners that was mentioned, which will enter into application the 5th of December, the framework decision on mutual recognition of probation orders, which are also entering into application on the 5th of December, and the European supervision order, mutual recognition of supervision orders, which will enter into application next year. Or could these four instruments, which are based on mutual trust, could work if we have poor detention conditions? Or could I accept as a judge the transfer of prisoner from one place where it enjoys, I would say, normal detention conditions to a place where he will be confronted to poor detention conditions, if not ill treatment, and so on? That's really an issue. The deadline for contributions to be sent to the Commission on this green paper is not over, so you can send, if you would be very happy to receive contributions from this organization or from individuals belonging to the organization or from other NGOs. This is it for procedural rights. I think I will stop there for procedural rights. We also address the rights of victims. This is very important for Commissioner Reding. And as a judge, been judge for 10 years, I can tell you that it in my system, in the system I know best, I know it's clear that, as we say, the victims were not the parties best placed in the criminal justice system of member states. So we want to ensure that the rights to a fair trial, of course, of suspect and accused are fully enforced, but we must equally look to the needs of those who fall victim to crime. We must not forget that the right to fair trial applies also to victims as to the defendant. We want to place a victim at the heart of the justice system. The European Union took action in 2001 with an old framework decision on the standing of victims in criminal proceedings. The problem is that most member states, of course, have put in place some level of victim protection for those who have implemented these framework decisions, not all the member states. However, these rules are largely been insufficient, and serious problems and significant inefficiencies remain. Victims' needs are generally not met by the national justice systems, and the level of victim rights differs very widely from country to country. There is a famous case which you will find in the impact assessment of the Commission attached to the directive of these British ladies whose son was severely injured in, I think it was in Greece or Portugal, and she had a lot of difficulties to get her rights enforced. This is really a prominent case that made a lot of place in the media in UK. But just because it's important for us to illustrate what we are doing by concrete case, real cases which affect citizens. We have adopted in May 2011 a comprehensive package on victim rights, a directive establishing minimum standards on the rights, support and protection of victims, and a regulation on the mutual recognition of protection measures taken in civil matters. We hope this will make real and meaningful change to the way victims are treated and the way they receive justice. Maybe I can quote one or two things we propose in this directive. We propose, of course, that all victims should have access to victim support services, and we know that normally in UK there are very efficient victim support services for victims. Training of police, prosecutors and staff court are also foreseen. We want, within the framework of the criminal proceedings, we want to give the possibility for the victims to be properly informed about their rights, about the criminal investigation and about criminal proceedings. We want to give them interpretation and translation. We want to give them the possibility to request a review of the decision not to prosecute, which is currently not possible in all member states. We want to enhance mediation and other forms of restorative justice. We want, and this is very important, to have a special treatment for more vulnerable victims, children and other vulnerable victims that could be identified following an individual assessment. For example, we want to avoid repeat victimization, secondary victimization. We want to avoid that the offender be able to threaten the victims, and this has to be enforced through a certain number of measures, including, for example, separate rooms in courts when the victim is attending the trial and the witness or the offenders, etc. This is what we are doing for victims. The regulation is about mutual recognition of an order to protect a victim in one member state, for example, a woman, unfortunately, this is mostly the case, who is victim of violence, domestic violence in one member state. She gets an order of protection in one member state. She travels, she moves to live in another member state, maybe to save her life. We want to ensure that, be it a civil or a criminal order, this order follows her, and then that the executing state be able to very swiftly, without any requirement, recognize and execute this order of protection. This is it with regard to victims. Third part, I will not speak much. European arrest warrants, the Commission has adopted, I just want to flag that the Commission has adopted, again this year, in a document, COM 2011/175 final, which is its third report on the implementation of the framework decision on European arrest warrants, which is very interesting. Basically, we discuss how to reinforce the rights of people who are surrendered within the scope, and one of the responses we gave is precisely our directive on access to a lawyer, but it's not enough. We also discuss the issue of proportionality, whether proportionality which lies within the duties of the issuing state, and certainly not the executing state, the day when the executing state will have the possibility to make a proportionality test with regard to a European arrest warrant issued in another member state, the day when this will happen, when we will come back 30 years ago at the time of mutual legal assistance period, because then it will be full discretion for the executing judge not to recognize a European arrest warrant. As the Commission is preparing, and probably for February, March, with regard to mutual recognition, of course, why I didn't mention a lot about mutual recognition, because we have put a hold, let's speak like this, to our work on mutual recognition, because to obtain mutual recognition, as I said, and insist, we need to build mutual trust. So first, we need to enhance procedural rights, and then we continue to develop our path on mutual recognition. But we are preparing a package, a big package, within a directive and a regulation on asset recovery of criminal assets for the beginning of next year. Directive on harmonization, Article 82, 83.1 of the treaty. This relates to the Lisbonization of the framework decision on harmonization of confiscation orders, the 2005/512, I think, framework decision. On one side, and on the other side, a regulation, probably, because now the legal basis allows us, 82.1 allows us to adopt regulations and not anymore directives or framework decisions, on mutual recognition of freezing orders and confiscation orders. In doing that, we will Lisbonize two old framework decisions of 2003 and 2006. Just to say that, you mentioned, madam, several framework decisions. There are many framework decisions on mutual recognition, financial penalties, for example, and so on. None of them, except European arrest warrant, has been fully implemented by the member states. Although they have been adopted on unanimity basis by all the member states. And the score is maybe very low. For example, the European evidence warrant, of course, adopted in 2008, which is dead now, because there has been a further proposal by the member states. I think only Ireland and Denmark, two opt-out states, have implemented it, which is interesting. I think I will stop. We also work on strengthening the Eurojust, which is a body in... Yes, Ben, I stop.
As you probably noticed, I've been given some instructions. And these are to the effect that although we're now at 20 to 4, we've perhaps got about 10 minutes that we can use for questions either to a Professor Baker or Monsieur Tell. But can I just, before I invite questions, thank Monsieur Tell for his, interesting, a most interesting a perspective of what the Commission has in mind. It may be that you didn't quite know that the Commission is so ambitious, not just for the Eastern European criminal justice systems, but for all our criminal justice systems. Can I also recognize something, that it's sometimes said that the Commission is rather elitist and has the view that it knows best for Europe. But what you have had this afternoon is an explicit invitation from Monsieur Tell to respond to the Green Paper on detention. And really going back to part a theme touched on by Professor Baker, it would be a mistake to think that Europe is out there and has nothing to do with me, because as Monsieur Tell reminded us, what the detention Green Paper is directed at are, for example, proposals on transfer of prisoners, and quite interesting, the proposed European supervision order. So if you have any suggestions, comments, or questions, perhaps you can either communicate with the Commission or possibly even speak to Monsieur Tell over a cup of tea, because Professor Baker tells me that the consultation period ends on the 30th of November.
Yes, but it could be extended a bit.
And I'm sure Monsieur Tell will listen to what's said over a cup of tea. However, we have about 10 minutes, and questions either to Professor Baker, Monsieur Tell, or comment on what we've heard. Now, I don't. Do we have a roving microphone? Or do we have a microphone? We have a roving microphone, so if you are to raise a hand, now there's a gentleman there, and if you just wait a moment to and if you want to identify who you are, it's part of the getting to know you experience.
I'm Dr. Cyrus Tarter from Strathclyde University. Question to both Stella, Professor Baker, and Monsieur Tell. Given that in the UK we have what might be a relatively unique situation of having a union state and separate jurisdictions, namely Scotland, I'm anxious to know how all of this might affect Scotland. In particular, is it inevitable, do you think, that in order to achieve mutual recognition, given that the EU tends to identify national justice systems as being synonymous with member states, which I think is a mistake here, because we have two national justice systems, do you think it's inevitable then that England and Wales will end up, well, in a sense, to achieve mutual recognition, we'll have to have harmonisation, in effect, within the United Kingdom, and therefore Scotland will lose its distinct identity?
I don't actually, or at least that's a new thought, I hadn't considered that. What the thing that has occurred to me about all of this is something slightly different, but not entirely unrelated, which is that if there are proposals for a large number of measures which do not fit comfortably with the model of UK criminal justice, and I do plead guilty here to thinking about England and Wales, I think, given that the other common law jurisdictions, most particularly Malta and Cyprus, are so small, but even Ireland is small, relatively speaking, whether in fact in due course the UK might get split off from the others and the others might harmonise with Europe while we keep, well, certainly in England and Wales, commitment to the common law, kind of Anglo-American, Australian kind of world is very entrenched. And I think it's quite hard even over quite a considerable period of time, to see that being watered down very significantly. It hadn't struck me that an effect of all of this would be for within the UK the differences to be ironed out. And I suppose actually given the current politics of the UK with devolution and the current Scottish government, that as things currently stand now, that seems even less likely. Maybe that would be wrong. I mean, the other thing I would say is in relation to the proposals that are coming along and the track record so far, which after all is pretty new post-Lisbon. I mean, the treaty's only been enforced just short of 2 years. It is very interesting to see what the UK government has been doing and what it has said to justify its decisions about opting in. Some it just gets on with it. The European Investigation Order, which is the measure that is going to supersede the European Evidence Warrant, which basically has never seen the light of day, it said it was opting into that from the beginning, not because it thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, but because it said it's much better to be there from the beginning negotiating hard with proper clout inside the system to make sure the ultimate instrument is something we can live with than to have everybody else negotiating it, coming up with something that they like, and then we would find that we were being disadvantaged because we weren't part of it and we'd have to sign up anyway because we're bottom of the heap and get stuck with something that we absolutely hated and didn't fit. Conversely, the measure, the one on child pornography, I think is the one where initially we said we weren't opting in, which came as a bit of a surprise to me. You might have thought that there wouldn't be an objection to that, and indeed there isn't as such, but it said in that case, we're not really that fussed about this because we basically think that anything that is going to come on the table, we do already, and our law is going to comply with it, so we're quite happy for everybody else to get on with it. And then afterwards, if we think it's okay, we'll opt in, as indeed we are actually doing. I think actually the one on legal advice that we're currently not opting into looks to me to be the first genuine not opting in example where it's something that we don't feel we can live with, and actually we're probably not going to sign up to it along the line if it stays as it currently is. So that's a rather kind of roundabout long answer to your question, but I don't know, it's a thought. I mean, politics change, and I mean, maybe that is the ultimate result, but it's not one that had struck me. I suppose the other thing I say is, yes, I mean, we keep seeing all this as being about change, all these proposals, but actually the truth is in quite a lot of cases, like with the new directives, actually we comply with what's being suggested anyway, and it's not that we're being told what to do by Brussels, it's more that, as I think was coming out in the second presentation just now, to some extent other member states are catching up with us, and quite ironically, given the level of debate here, in some instances at least, it's more that we actually have a positive story to tell to other people that we could show off, but the politics are all against actually doing that. So the influence spreads in both directions.
Did you tell?
No, the answer to your question is no, for me.
That's straightforward.
No, you're not the only federal state, so to speak, in the EU. Yes, but I mean, Germany has the same problem with the Länders, because some Länders have their own means of justice, their own systems. Of course, it's not. We, first of all, I think on a political point of view, on a legal point of view, this, of course, we don't discuss with Scotland, we don't discuss with Wales, we don't discuss with North, we discuss with UK. And therefore, if there are specific, different judicial systems within a member state, there should be coordination, political coordination inside. And that's not for me to comment on that, but this is purely internal UK business, I would say. Legally speaking, I can tell you that in the civil law side, for which I worked several years, we were obliged, because of your system, to introduce, in conflict of laws instruments, to introduce so-called federal clause within the instruments to take into account that there is a system of conflict of law within the UK between Scotland and England. But for criminal matters, until now, there was no need to do that. But of course, legally speaking, if we have to take into account that situation, why not? I mean, but until now, either in harmonization or mutual recognition, there was no need to take into account, legally speaking, this situation. This is the only answer I can make at that stage.
Am I correct in picking up that the direction that the Commission is looking at is harmonization rather than uniformity? Or is the aim one system of criminal procedure for the whole union, or is it harmonious but different systems?
No, no. In the treaty, we are supposed, well, not supposed, we are obliged to respect the traditions of the system of the member states. According to our legal basis, again, which is 82.2, we cannot harmonize, fully harmonize. We are only setting up minimum rules, minimum standards. Mm-hmm. That's very important. And we are acting only with regard by the way of directives.
Yes. Microphone for the gentleman in the just in the middle, at the aisle.
Thank you. Councillor Gordon MacAskill, East Renfrewshire Council, Conservative Group. We were told earlier on there was a difference between the Human Rights Act and the European Convention, although they weren't entirely discreet. Given that the European Convention says quite categorically that signatories to it, that long-standing practices and procedures would not be affected after signing, how do you account for the fact that Scottish law has been virtually turned upside down in the last year by apparent adherence to a convention which is not supposed to affect long-standing practices?
I don't have the text which the United Kingdom was the first European country to sign in 1950 in front of me, but to be frank, the long-standing practices text, I can't think where that comes. Whether one would describe the decision in Cadder as turning Scots law upside down, possibly as a topic for John Scott tomorrow. I don't know if either of our other speakers can offer an answer. I think you've kind of stymied me.
I don't feel competent to answer that question. I mean, basis of expertise is in the union rather than in the convention system, and I'm certainly not here to speak on the part of the convention system, and I don't know enough about Scottish criminal justice either to answer it from the other end of the telescope. But it's not the only occasion when these questions come up which stump everybody. I was in an audience some while ago when the Lisbon changes were about to come into force, and speaking about the transitional phase, and the other speaker who had the additional problem that he was a civil servant, a national civil servant from the UK, and I wasn't, so he had even less freedom to speak. And he was talking about all the opt-out arrangements that the UK had negotiated, and the speaker got up and said, I'm fed up with hearing about all these special arrangements for the UK. The new treaties have Article 50, which for the first time provides a member state with the right to withdraw from the union. Why don't you just press the trigger and go? which was said with some, I think, personal hostility directed at the two of us, and of course meant that for the rest of the conference, everybody was coming and saying, are you all right? We felt very sympathetic to you, and so on. Like I said, I don't feel competent to answer that question. I'm sorry.
I don't know. Is anyone in the hall going to feel competent to answer that question? I think maybe come back to John Scott tomorrow. I think would be my suggestion. Do we have time for any further questions, or is it time for tea? One more question. Well, if there's no more questions in plenary, as it were, we'll break for I think about 25 minutes. There's tea in the in the circulation area. I'm sure our speakers would be happy to speak to you, but can I just express on all our behalf the thanks for two such excellent, stimulating starting speeches. Thank you very much indeed.